So Donald Trump now says he was being sarcastic when he made the false claim that President Obama was the founder of ISIS. He doubled down on the claim for several days, but this morning he tweeted out, "They don't get sarcasm?" Well, perhaps he was responding to the chorus of voices saying that while how President Obama has handled ISIS can be debated, ISIS started before Obama was even president. Let's get a look at that history and some of what lies ahead for the next president with Ben Watson, news editor for Defense One, the website that focuses on national security issues. He joins us from Washington. Ben, welcome.
Hey, great to be here, Robin.
And good to talk to you. And when you heard Donald Trump say President Obama and Hillary Clinton, but Obama particularly founded ISIS, what did you think?
At this point, it's not a surprise in the campaign to hear these stretches or fabrications. There's a million different ways to kind of describe them, but the bottom line is it was not literally true.
Well, what is true? When did ISIS start? Take us through.
So ISIS, as we know it, started around 2006 when its predecessor group, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, headed by a man named Abu Musab Zarqawi, was killed. And 5 days later, the remaining Al-Qaeda and ISIS fighters renamed the group the Islamic State in Iraq. And it was 4 years after that, when their leader again was killed in a U.S. raid, that the current leader of ISIS, al-Baghdadi, took over.
We know that there's been a split in the Muslim world for centuries between the Sunni and the Shia Muslims. So the underpinning upset goes back centuries. But is it true, as some analysts have said, Lina Khatib, for instance, Carnegie Middle East Center, that the beginning of all of this really was post the invasion of Iraq, the de-Baathization, the dismantling of the military, and many of those military leaders then went and formed some of these groups or participated in them?
There's a well-respected Middle East scholar, Charles Lister, of the Middle East Institute, who backs that up with some pretty thorough documentation in his book, his recent book, The Syrian Jihad. Saddam Hussein, before the invasion, was trying to contain the Sunni unrest in his country by sending some of his officers into mosques and into Sunni territory to kind of foment unrest. Well, the consequence of that was that a lot of these officers wound up becoming more wrapped up in the broader Sunni struggle against Shia and against non-Sunnis and non-Muslims. And whenever Saddam fell, of course, the military was disbanded. And a lot of these people kept up their fight that they had been charged for even before the invasion. Many of them went over and joined Zarqawi's al-Qaeda project.
Well, what about another claim that President Obama created a vacuum when he drew down the troops in Iraq? Now, we should say this was a George W. Bush timeline that was then implemented by Obama. After Iraq wouldn't agree to give U.S. troops who were in Iraq essentially immunity in civil cases. But is that now seen as a mistake, that troop drawdown?
I wouldn't characterize it as a mistake because we followed the recommendations of the democracy, such as it was, that we had installed in Iraq. And so for that reason, you can't go into a country saying that you're going to install a democracy and then a democracy doesn't really want to give you the certain protections you need to keep your troops there. You know, then you become kind of a dictator advocate in a way, pushing aside the very cause you said you were coming to the country for.
What about the way the Obama administration has handled ISIS in Syria, elsewhere?
It seems to be in line with President Obama's broader intent when he had come into office in 2008 to wind down these wars. And so it's consistent with his light footprint approach to some of these wars where you had a lot of American soldiers getting into harm's way in combat and coming over, you know, to Dover Air Force Base in a casket. And he got tired of seeing that. A lot of the American public did, too. And so what's the kind of counter proposal to having a lot of ground forces? It's going over and it's advising and training and allowing these local nations' militaries to handle the fight themselves. Now, when you pan over to Syria, what do we do about the Assad regime, which has perpetuated all of this violence since 2011? And really, even before that, fomented its own insurgency and Sunni kind of tensions within the country. Well before that, they were documented as sending some extremists to Iraq in the early stages of the Iraq invasion. So he has a long history of of trying to co-opt an insurgency to his ends and kind of keep him as the best bad option in Syria. And that's sort of what the U.S. is working with overall, is a lot of, you know, such as much as it can pull together, the best bad options.
Well, and you mentioned President Obama's light touch. That's one of the criticisms of a candidate Donald Trump. He just wants to bomb the heck out of everything. And we didn't mention drone strikes, which are, you know, a big part of the Obama administration plan. The Pentagon just recently detailing how many drone strikes there have been and under what situation they should be used. So we're going to put aside that political debate about how to go forward in Syria. What is a new president facing? President Obama, speaking at the Pentagon last week, ticked off a long list of recent terrorist attacks. Let's listen.
We've seen terrible bombings in Iraq and in Jordan and Lebanon, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and Afghanistan. Attacks on an Istanbul airport, a restaurant in Bangladesh, Bastille Day celebrations at a church in France, and a music festival in Germany.
Well, Ben Watson, just in hearing that list, you're reminded, too, you can't bomb the heck out of all of those places to stop, you know, the bombings that are there. I just remind you that this isn't just contained in one place, obviously something that we know. But where is the U.S. fighting wars?
The U.S. is fighting wars in terms of dropping bombs in about seven countries. And it began in Afghanistan and Pakistan after the 9/11 attacks, when we were pursuing al-Qaeda and we were pursuing the Taliban, who had harbored al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Now, beyond that, in less than a year, it went over and shifted over to Yemen, where we took out some al-Qaeda fighters there in the first drone strike there in 2002. And then over to Iraq, of course, with the precursors to ISIS. On to Somalia, Libya, and now Syria. Those are the ones that are cited for the 2001 authorization for the use of military force that initially started America's response to the 9/11 attacks. So seven countries where we're bombing and many more that we have an eye on.
And how many ISIS fighters do analysts think there are?
The latest count that I've seen is upwards of 25,000, the lower end being 19,000. The numbers on this stuff are really shifty, and even to use a U.S. commander's words from, I think, 2 days ago, he called the numbers game really squishy.
But even if you double the guessed number of 25,000, even if you doubled that, not even a fraction of the soldiers in conventional war. Is there a time, can you think of a time historically, a military situation, where it's been this dispersed, it's been this... You know, the phrase that came up after Iraq was whack-a-mole.
I can't think of a time when it's been quite this dispersed. That's sort of the overarching difficulty here. And, of course, the difficulty pinning down the administration to using the 2001 authorization, which 15 years later they're still using across another half dozen countries. It's an interesting phenomenon that's made all the more difficult by the internet, by social media, and by globalization kind of broadly. The way that everyone is becoming more interconnected, and the way that money can be transferred, the way that the whole game of messaging is played and carried out.
So, you know, you speak to all analysts, you aggregate information. What's the thinking about the one thing that has to happen, the one thing a new president has to do in order to either stem this or contain it? Or what's the conventional thinking?
Well, it's nice to think that there could be a one thing, but it's a networked, it's a broad and all-encompassing deal that, of course, the military facet is only one component of. It's only one side of this whole game that involves, largely, maybe more than anything, an inclusive kind of governance model, one that will take, you know, the frustrations that led to the rise of what we now know as ISIS after 2011. It was a lot of sectarianism and a lot of Sunni repression in the state of in the country of Iraq. Now, if you're able to kind of find ways to get representative governments that include these people's complaints and incorporate them into solid action, where the complaints do not turn into violence, it really, from what I understand, it's inclusive governance. If you're looking for one particular thing. That's easier said than done. I mean, look at, you know, everybody would say, look at America. It took a long time for us to sort of, insofar as we're able to, get on our feet. And so to expect these folks to kind of come to is kind of fast food thinking. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's not going to happen probably for many, many years.
That's Ben Watson, news editor for Defense One. We'll link you to his reporting at hereandnow.org. Ben, thank you as always.
Thanks a lot, Robin. I appreciate it.